This is intercultural yoga. Hello, my name is Raymond Reyes. I'm the Associate Provost and Chief Diversity Officer at Gonzaga University, and also your host for the Intercultural Yoga Podcast Program. This is a program where we talk about the issues that make us uncomfortable, but yet in that space of discomfort is an opportunity for growth and development. Today, I have two guests that I'm very excited about getting to know more and be able to talk about these issues of diversity, inclusion, and equity. First, I have Haley Wilson, a senior who's majoring in business and English, is also the diversity chair for the Gonzaga Student Body Association, and just an overall wonderful senior going out in a full blaze of glory with her activism and her commitment to social justice. I also have Izzy Carranza, who is a law student and what they call an L3. He's going to graduate very soon with his doctorate in law. And he's also very active in the law school. I see him in meetings here again around justice, inclusion, and equity. Today, I want to talk about change. The year 2020 has been quite a fascinating year in so many different ways, on so many different levels, physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. It's almost been almost a rites of passage collectively for the 7.8 billion people that live on this planet, and more particularly those that are part of the Gonzaga community. So what I want to do is, I want to tell a quick story if I can, because I really want to animate our time together, really trying to take a deep dive into change and what the nature of change is, and how do we midwife change? How does change occur? This is and I'm going to, in the interest of time, paraphrase the story, but it comes out of Ken Keyes, his book, The 100th Monkey, and based on some research that was done in the mid-1950s on three islands off the coast of Japan. And they had these primates on these three islands, and they were studying primate behavior. And they had these video cameras in lunch boxes, and they were monitoring the behavior of these three colonies on three separate islands of primates. And every day what would happen is a helicopter would hover over the three islands and drop sweet potatoes down on the ocean, on the beach area. And every day they would come and pick them up and eat them with grit, with the sand all over them. They noticed on one particular island, on one day, an adolescent male primate by the name of Imo, they named the different primates Imo, he did something different. He would pick up the sweet potato that was gritty, he'd walk to another area of the island, not short distance, and there was fresh water streaming out, and he would wash it before he ate it. And every day he kept on doing this. And every day some of his playmates would try to get him to conform to the old way and eat it gritty. But he persisted and adopted this new pattern of behavior. And then little by little, they noticed on this one island, all his peers, his generation, the younger generation, adopted this new practice. And they kept on doing this. And the older, the women and the males, adults, were trying to get them to conform to the old way. But the younger generation on this one island persisted with the new behavior. So to accelerate the story a bit, what happened was soon on this one island, then it was the female monkeys, the mothers, the aunties, the grandmothers adopted the new way of being. And finally, the males on this one island. But what's fascinating is what the research indicates is that within the end of the month, the other two islands, independent of the one, also adopted the new practice. Then no text machines, no communications. I mean, it just happened, all three islands. They talk about this idea of critical mass achieved, exponentially change occurs on a broader scale. Rupert Sheldrake calls them morphogenic fields. Malcolm Gladwell became famous with his notion of the tipping point moment. When critical mass is achieved, change happens at an exponential level. People talk about the end of apartheid in South Africa in that way. They talk about the demise of the Berlin Wall that way. So the reason why I told you that story, you represent the younger generation. We just come out of some hard times, and we got some hard times in front of us in terms of this pandemic and other things that have happened in terms of the racial reckoning in this country. And what I'm wondering is, what is that new practice that needs to be adopted? What does it take for change to occur? Why are we keep on repeating history? What is the difference between a stumbling block and a stepping stone? Someone once told me the difference is how high you raise your foot, the difference between a stumbling block and a stepping stone. So I'm gonna ask you, Haley, first, because you're an undergraduate and you're coming along, and then Izzy, I'm gonna ask you second. As I told the story and I asked the question, what is it, this new practice that we need to adopt as a culture, as a community, to truly sustain social change for greater levels of inclusivity and equity? What is that magic sauce? What is that magic new behavior that maybe your generation is currently midwifing? Any thoughts on that, Haley?
Yeah, I think that's a really wonderful and important question right now. I think in light of the BSU incident that happened, 2 weeks ago, I think that has a couple of important things for us to think about, in that that was a moment where our campus sort of came together and said, wow, something really needs to change. And we all collectively sort of recognize this need. But what I think is distinctive in that moment is the idea that for our students of color, for our Black students, especially for our marginalized students, we always walk around with that sort of intersectional thinking and considering the ways in which the institution or sort of daily microaggressions, how oppression and discrimination sort of manifest in daily life. And it isn't just in these grand, really terrible things like the hate crime that occurred, but there are daily sort of barriers and instances of discrimination and oppression that happen. And that's sort of a mindset that, if that could be internalized and carried on by all peoples all the time, then we could really start working towards significant change. Because what gets in the way is people reversing back to, oh, well, that's really not that important, or there's other bigger priorities. When in fact, we have to sort of recognize, like, hey, our students, our marginalized students, can't not see these things. And they also, not only can they not see those things, but they're thinking intersectionally, right? They're thinking about how students who are different than them, how people who are different than them and hold different identities are facing different kinds of oppression and discrimination. So I think sort of what we saw was this awakening almost to the fact that, like, there are those really harsh realities of racism and all of the isms, but that certain individuals can sort of forget or sort of ignore or sort of move on. But if we were to internalize, and everybody were to internalize those realities a little bit more, I think it could push us to more significant change.
Okay, great, good, thank you. Izzy, I suspect that a big reason why you're interested in law and why you want to become a lawyer is, in a way, being a lawyer and practicing social justice could be a version of internal activism, where you're working as an activist within the society structures of rule of law, right? So as I told the story of the 100th monkey, is it possible to create change within the system? Or is what people talk about in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder, that it's the structure itself, it's basically some of the laws itself that are racist that need to change? Well, what's your take on that?
Well, again, I share Haley's point. I think these are some great questions. And I think, you know, they require one to think deeply about them. And I think that, you know, part of the reason why you might have called it a magic sauce is because we still don't know all of the ingredients that are needed for it. But kind of to go to your question, I think that it requires a little bit of both. I think that it does require, and you're spot on, like, one of the reasons that I wanted to pursue a degree in the law is so that I can be a voice for the voiceless and for people that are oppressed. And that, you know, to some extent, to some people, that might be looked at as an activist. You know, that I'm raising up issues that other people just don't for whatever reason. So I think that it does require to some extent that you work within, you know, the confines of the structures that are already set. But I think it's done in a way so that you can actually get to an end where, you know, if you start putting light on some of the issues that are affecting certain people or certain groups, then some people will just naturally understand that some of these structures are inherently broken. They're inherently racist, and they need to be changed from the ground up. So I think that for me, that's the approach that I would take. Like, work within the system to the extent that I can, but at the same time with the end in mind that there are going to be some of these things, some of these laws that just have to be overturned or changed. And I think that's what we're seeing across the country. And I know that not everybody will agree with that, but I think that we need both. I just recently had a conversation with some of my friends as far as, like, you know, what is the best approach that we take? Do we take a Martin Luther King approach, mm-hmm. which some people feel like is working too much within the system and that is palatable for the majority? Or do we do like, another approach to like Malcolm X, to the extent that we understood what he was doing, which is more against the systems that are in place. But for me, I think it requires a little bit of both.
Yeah. I appreciate you mentioning Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, because lately I've been hearing a lot of that in terms of creating change. I know that some of you might know that I've been at Gonzaga. This is my 33rd year, and I've seen, you know, the students are here every 4 years, in your case, every 3 years with the law school. And it just seems many times things change at a glacial pace. But there's something different about what happened a couple of weeks ago, just like there's something different that happened in George Floyd's case. And that is, there's been a shift and a focus to structures more so than individual racism. And I'm just wondering, at Gonzaga, I've seen so many instances where student activism has made a difference, just like it did in the 1960s with helping contribute to the end of the Vietnam War. So the student voice is powerful, and student activism does get results. And I think back to the 1990s when there was the racial incidents at the law school, and then the year 2002 with the And We Stayed video, where a group of students talked about persistence and cultural resilience and staying here despite their challenges at Gonzaga. Then 2017, we had the Where Were You When video that was done. And more recently, the student demands from the Black Student Union. And I'm hoping, going back to that magic sauce, let's unpack the ingredients. What does it take for staff and faculty and administrators and trustees and regents and people with power and privilege at Gonzaga University who can make a sustainable difference? What do we need to do to stay vigilant and not fall asleep at the wheel? Why? What can we do to have less dependency on student activism and to always react to what needs to happen? I'm curious, what kind of advice, what kind of wisdom as young people would you give to us old ones that many times are complicit in maintaining the status quo? Even somebody like me who wants to believe that I have the spirit of an activist, but yet I'm part of the very structure, I'm part of the very system that needs to change. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, I would say in my role, being sort of close to admin in certain instances and then also removed in other cases, there's a lot of reinventing the wheel every year, right? You know, I'm a senior, I'm going to leave next year. A lot of the work that I'm doing right now, the big question is, well, how does that get continued? How does that get taken up and internalized by Gonzaga as an institution? Because I'm going to leave, somebody's going to fill my spot, and our admin going to ask the same exact questions? And is the next person in my role going to have to figure out those same exact answers? So I think sort of the onus is on the admin a little bit here, where it, you know, Raymond, exactly, like, the student activism is great and it does have a really big impact. And yet at times when we're sitting in those meetings with Thane and his constituents, they're not necessarily internalizing the things that we're saying and then instituting that in a particular way, because we really do not have that power, but we have the opinions and we have sort of that lived experience of being in the school. But it doesn't really do much to say those same things or slightly different things every single year. There's sort of like a missing next step, and there's sort of a loss of momentum when you have to kind of backtrack and have like a new subset of students, right? So I think there's sort of this lack of sort of responsibility, if you will, in that admin and faculty and staff always want to hear those student voices, but to some extent, the students can only do so much in the time period that they're here. So it's sort of hard to like hone in on this, what you're asking, right? Like, what is the ingredient, one specific thing that they need to do? But it's almost like, okay, you hear the student voices, what is like a tangible action or something very specific that you can do for them that they cannot do? Kind of like, where does the power fall? You can hear them, but then on your side, you know, what's that thing next? And also, where's that communication piece? How do you ensure that gets back to the students? Because I think that's also a big part of it, right? We can't see, and they also can't see.
No, that's a good point. I think you identified one ingredient to the magic sauce, and that's continuity of commitment. How do you sustain an effort over time beyond the shelf life of a graduating student? And so communication is essential, and almost like a relay race, passing the baton, but making sure there's an embodiment of the previous experience that the person carrying forward has. So that it is, you've identified that, you know, trying to transcend the repetition, the, as you said, the reinventing the wheel, constantly doing that, getting out of that cycle. I'm wondering, Izzy, at the law school and graduate programs such as the law school, whether there's any best practices that you've identified after 3 years there that address what Haley's talking about, any best practices or any way to assure continuity from an L1 to an L3, or the professors that teach at the law school, that kind of create that thread of continuity that Haley's describing as essential to keep the momentum going. Anything there?
You know, I think that first I want to acknowledge that, like, what Haley has described, I think, is some of the same obstacles and barriers that we have been facing at the law school, at least since my time that I have been there. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the ways that we are trying to, because we have that same worry, our law school has recently had a new organization that was created, the Black Law Student Association. And they also recently had delivered like a demand letter before the BSU incident. And I am, you know, keep on thinking about like the parallels that are there. But one of the concerns in the conversations that we had is like, you know, some of these things that are being asked for are going to have to happen after we're here. So how do we keep this momentum alive, just how you described? And I think one of our solutions has been to create a community within the law school, starting with the student body, that passes on the information that we know of, like the fights that we have had, to the next upcoming class. And we talk about like the issues that we have faced, how we have resolved them, so that the next class that comes in has that, you know, I think it was described as, like, as institutional knowledge of like what has happened already and how they can attack certain issues. And we hope that by creating this community and this institutional knowledge within the student groups, they can pick up kind of how you described with like, we can pass on the baton and they can continue the fight as opposed to having to pick up from square one.
No, that's very helpful. I want to resist getting high up the abstraction ladder right now. I get always accused of living in my head, but I need to say this. I'm wondering what both of you are describing is intergenerational transmission of knowledge. And there have been cultures, and particularly tribal indigenous cultures, that had no written language, had no libraries per se, had no videotapes and ways to archive things, you know, in a concrete way. But yet there was a continuity of cultural knowledge that spanned hundreds, if not thousands of years. It almost seems like for a culture to sustain its narrative over time, it needs to memorialize somehow, some sort of rituals or symbols or ceremony or something. Because what happens is, it seems to me as an administrator, it's mind share. We get so busy. A Jesuit once told me this, he said, the first thing to do is always keep the first thing first as the first thing to do. It sounds like psychobabble, but when you have hundreds of emails and you have hundreds of different things coming at you simultaneously, it's difficult to have a single point of focus on really what matters. And if people can't feel safe and have a sense of belongingness, everything else doesn't really matter. And so I'm wondering, part of the solution of what we're talking about is to avoid having split attention. In fact, there's an old saying that says, split attention rings like a cracked bell. How do we all help each other? Remember, we all want the same things. We all come from the same base of core values, and to assist each other to remember and not forget. That's going to be the challenge. I'm wondering right now, is there any way that you can recommend how administrators like myself and the senior administrative leadership of the university can keep focused on this, knowing that it's about a mind share, it's about bench strength, it's about capacity. And it's not like people don't care, because they care when it's brought to their attention. But then there's so many other competing demands. In your life, tell me, how do you make priorities? Maybe there's insights into how one prioritizes. And if belongingness and safety are essential across human difference, then we're every day this is going to be at the top of the list and not something, a long laundry list of what needs to be done. Any thoughts on that, as I kind of wandered around a bit on a few topics, but I'm just curious about this idea of having the discipline to remain focused and keep our eye on the prize. Anybody? Yeah. Ailey?
Well, yeah, in terms of kind of climbing down the ladder of abstraction, I think that a lot of students who have, like in GSBA, for instance, so having some like sort of relationship with admin, we're sort of always pining and trying really hard to get meetings with the admin. You know, they're busy, they're doing lots of things. But what if we saw a role reversal, right? Like we see a role reversal when things like this happen, like with BSU, something just so abhorrent and terrible that all of a sudden admin is, you know, pining to get student voices into their offices. But prior to that, we had already sort of been pining. And then after something like that happens, and even just during in general, there's a lot of questions that students like, hey, you know, how do we solve this problem? Or how do you feel about this? And I wonder what would happen if admin who recognize those problems have heard them from previous students could instead say, we want to meet with students, but B, we want to propose or present to them problems that we've heard in the past, get their opinions on that, and then also propose some sorts of solutions or ideas that we've had in relation to those problems, right? As opposed to asking students entirely to come up with policy or to come up with change. Because while we do have great ideas and while BSU's demands were really great, it is at the same time sort of asking us to work within a framework, higher administration, higher university, whatever, that we're not necessarily familiar with, whereas they are. So how can they more directly approach us with some of those solutions and ideas and then let us sort of evaluate their effectiveness or what we think about them versus the other way around, if that makes sense?
No, it does. As you speak, I'm thinking about Brian Steverson, Just Mercy, and how he talks about the importance of keeping close to the problem or keeping close to the issue. And I think that what you're talking about in terms of the relationship, keep a student engaged when there's no crisis going on, I think is important.